Today is Friday, March 19th, 2010. I'm Brad Pepping, and you're listening to News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us on this glorious Friday evening. Today, we're happy to bring you international and national news from our friends at Free Speech Radio News, Groundwire, and CHRY in Toronto. On the show, we'll be looking into the recent voting irregularities during January's AMS student election here at UBC. We have an update from AMS election officials about the 731 fraudulent votes that were cast from a single IP address. Later, we'll have an update about Canadian citizen Omar Khadr, who is being detained at Guantanamo Bay. We'll also be catching another installment of Groundwire, produced this week by CKDU Radio in Halifax. All this plus headlines from Free Speech Radio News and your weekend weather forecast this hour on News 101. First up in campus news, we turn our attention to the recent voting irregularities in, as I said, the January 2010 AMS election. This Monday, the Alma Mater Society reported that after backing out the previously mentioned 731 fraudulent votes, the results of the AMS executive positions will not be affected. In a press release from the student organization, the votes, cast from the same IP address, affected only the races for UBC Senate, the tuition referendum question, and the voter-funded media contest on the ballot. Those unaffected were AMS executive positions, international student representative, UBC Board of Governors student representatives, the Student Legal Fund Society, and the UBC Publication Society Board of Directors. According to the press release, in the case of the UBC Senate election, the AMS will withhold judgment on the tentative results until the university has determined a proper course of action. The results for the tuition referendum question are unresolved at this time. In terms of the voter-funded media contest, the AMS will pay out the difference to those who are owed more money. According to the AMS, they take this matter very seriously, and they are in consultation with the Forensic Data Recovery Incorporation, taking all steps necessary to ensure that the voting irregularities are being properly investigated. Also, the AMS will resolve all issues with the online voting system to prevent any problems in the future, according to the press release. That's all we have for this. That's all we have right now for this. But make sure you do come back to News 101 as we will be covering what's going on with these decisions in the near future. In national news, we're now going to turn to the fine folks from CKDU Radio in Halifax who put together this week's edition of Groundwire.
We should be outraged that, in fact, we're using the most expensive, least effective system.
Many of these groups have been under severe attack for their alleged anti-Semitism.
When it's the people, it's about the people, you know, like, why don't people have more power?
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news.
I'm Tarun.
I'm Jackie.
And I'm Warda. This week's Groundwire is produced from Flamington Park's Flama City Media Project, CFPK 92.1 FM in Toronto.
In this week's edition,
Halifax plans for better biking,
Canadian campuses appeal for boycotts against Israel,
and later on, feminists dismiss Canada's official report.
Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. We misclicked a link here, but we're going to turn now to the actual groundwire for this week. That was last week's groundwire from Toronto. This is the one from Halifax.
Provincial budget on February 8th. So a freeze to the base.
Welcome to the March 13th edition of Groundwire. Grassroots news from people on the ground, coast to coast to coast.
And Calgary have voted to approve the maximum tuition increase for students. Groundwire spokesperson Alexandria Eldridge, the Canadian University of Alberta, wrote about these increases and others being proposed by the institutions. Certainly reminds people of what apartheid was in the South African context.
Use of this terminology, I think, rightfully so, should awaken both a memory in people around the world of what apartheid was and the evils of it and why it is still going on today.
In this edition of Groundwire, we hear from the youth of the Flemo City Media Project in Toronto's Flemingdon Park. An apology and settlement for the former residents and descendants of Africville, Nova Scotia, garners mixed reactions from the community. Blind transit users in Toronto are being refused access to the city's accessible transit service, Wheeltrans. The arts community in St. John's, Newfoundland celebrates International Women's Day. And we take a look at Israeli Apartheid Week activities across the country, along with reactions by Ontario politicians and pro-Israel groups. All that is coming up, but first, the headlines. From CKUT in Montreal, here's Steve Kerr.
Canwest Global Communications has agreed to sell a controlling stake of its shares to media giant Shaw Communications. Canwest is one of Canada's largest media corporations and broadcasts channels including Global TV and the National Geographic Channel. The sale to Shaw Communications has prompted criticism from media diversity activists. Steve Anderson at openmedia.ca explained the damaging effects the sale could have.
Like a handful of companies control most media in Canada. We have a very highly concentrated media market, especially in Western Canada, where I'm at right now. And this will mean that there'll kind of be one less entity, there'll be one less media company out there.
Anderson was also concerned that the move could lead to a conflict of interest.
You know, we believe in, as much as possible, separating content and carriage. And, you know, the Shaw taking control of Canwest Broadcast, it sort of muddies the water there, where now they have a commercial interest to favor their own content, and they also control the means of distribution.
The sale is pending approval by the CRTC. Part of the CRTC's mandate is to promote media diversity within Canada. Anderson closed by warning the CRTC of the potential danger of the takeover.
It's a powerful company owning yet more media.
For Groundwire, this is Steve Elton Kerr in Montreal.
Tessa Vanderhart from CJUM Winnipeg has this report.
The United Food and Commercial Workers Union says that lack of occupational health and safety coverage for Alberta's farm workers has resulted in 23 deaths and countless injuries over the past few years. If farm workers were covered under the Occupational Health and Safety Act, agricultural employers would be required to educate workers about the dangers of working on a farm and provide adequate training. Workers would also have the right to a health and safety committee and to refuse dangerous work. Stan Raper is a national coordinator of the Agriculture Workers Alliance, which operates in conjunction with the UFCW, which is the largest private sector union in Canada.
Well, basically, the campaign called End the Harvest of Death for Alberta farm workers is to try and secure occupational health and safety legislation for agriculture workers in the province. Every other province in Canada has that protection now for agriculture workers, and Alberta is the last holdout, and something that we're working hard to try and secure for them. It's time that the Alberta government realized that there's some serious problems when workers go to work. They should be able to return back to the families and not be sent home in a box or without a limb. These are serious, serious situations, and there is an obligation on behalf of the government of Alberta to act.
Thomas Lukaszuk, Alberta's Minister of Employment and Immigration, told University of Alberta student newspaper The Gateway the government wants, quote, to make sure that our farmers are safe and that all the workers on farms are safe. But at the same time, we want to make sure that their needs are also met, that we're not paralyzing the industry. For Groundwire, this is Tessa Vanderhart from CJUM in Winnipeg.
Back to Montreal now with CKUT's Joel Bard.
On February 21st, around 100 Montrealers packed into the basement of Union United Church. The mostly black crowd attended a press conference held by two groups of youths who say that they were racially profiled and mistreated by Montreal Transit authorities. Both groups have filed complaints with the Quebec Human Rights Commission. They are also seeking financial redress. Samantha Hyman Roberts, one of the complainants, spoke about her experience. She said that she and three friends were riding a train when they were singled out by transit authorities. After failing to produce a ticket, which she contends she'd just thrown out, officials asked her to disembark. And when she questioned them why, they physically abused her. "The authorities," she told the crowd, "grabbed me and dragged me to the ground in the train. They put their knees on my back and tried to put handcuffs on my wrist." They then wrote her over $700 worth of fines. Elaine Towes is a civil rights advocate who's been working closely with Hyman Roberts and the other youths. She says that these recent cases are nothing new, that racial profiling is a major issue in Montreal.
"Based on my work here at CRAR, I've seen many cases involving STM inspectors, some cases involving the Montreal police. When we see this type of pattern of targeting these groups of people and treating them in an abusive manner, unrespectfully, I see that as a pattern of racial profiling."
Yet despite being troubled by the pattern, Taos says she is heartened by the way Montreal's black community mobilizes around such cases. Indeed, as made evident at Union United, a strong and active support system seems to exist. Signing off for Groundwire, I'm Joel Bard.
And now for our features. First up, the Groundwire Community Radio Report. 3 years ago, the Flemo City Media Project was born in Toronto's Flemington Park. Every week since, youth have gathered to broadcast locally using a low-power, unlicensed station they built themselves, calling their station CFPK. Besides giving youth a voice, the project is also incubating new artists and forming new partnerships in the community. Groundwire introduces you to the dynamic hosts, producers, and musicians of the Flemo City Media Project.
This is the sound of Flemo City Media. Flemo City Media is a not-for-profit organization devoted to helping people, especially youth, in the Flemington Park community. We broadcast a low-power local station we call CFPK out of Flemington Park. Right now, we don't really have a license, but we're hoping to get one soon.
Hi, I'm Aisha Rowe. I'm the project coordinator for Flemo City Media. And Alex and Huey came out with some basically random pieces of junk, came to the community center, saw some kids and was like, "Hey, we're going to try to build a radio transistor. Do you want to help?" And then one day put the antenna up on the roof and went out in his car, turned the dial while the youth in the building at the center hosted a show, and everyone was just ecstatic when they caught the frequency and they heard their voices over the air. And that really is the birth of Flemo City Media and the cornerstone of what we are. We started as CFPK Flemo City Radio, and now we've expanded to include media arts and leadership capacity building for youth. So I grew up in Thorncliffe, and so I know what it is to be a youth in this community. Flemington and Thorncliffe Park is a first and second immigrant settlement community. It has been labeled by our local government as one of the 13 priority neighborhoods, and that's because it is a low-income and community with most people living at the poverty line or below.
When you tell them where you live, I mean, I'm in show choir, right, and I'm the only Noir person there, so I consider myself Noir. I call myself Noir. One chocolate chip in a pancake batter, and it's like, should that belong there? But then the topic just comes up, where do you live? And then you tell them Flemo or off the coast of Flemo, they're like, oh, you live there. I guess I would consider it a ghetto-y area. I mean, there's like different ethnicities here, right? So everyone comes from a different culture, and what you think is right for from your culture is wrong for another culture, right? So like you need to have at least one friend from every culture here. Like I guess I would call the research center the heart of Flamo in a way, because that's where most people in Flamo get to know each other.
FCM generally shows you the best of Flamo Park. It shows you the kind of stuff that most people tend not to see or overlook. So it really does. It really does put a positive spin on everything that people say is negative. My name's Tarun. I've gotten a lot of experience with talking by being on FCM, and it's helped me in school and other areas. I owe a lot to FCM for letting me do this and learn more about myself and others in the process. We have had a lot of hookups with this program. Royal Conservatory of Music, Einstein Hype, and more. Deal's been involved with most of it from the start.
Well, we had this mini program, Unsigned Hype, that's its name. At the end of the program, one of the hosts from CHRY, her name's Ome, she invited us to go down to CHRY and actually play some of our stuff on radio live. It was a real good experience because we actually got to know what it feels like to have a timeline. We also got to play the things that we created in Unsigned Hype.
We have a lot of talented youth that come through our doors, and they're making really great music and creative material, not just music.
The only way I found out that I had a voice was I came to Flamo City Media. It sort of builds your character. I mean, the radio is anonymous, right? No one's really looking at you, so you can say whatever you want. You're free to express yourself.
Right now, Flamo City Media is about 3 years old. But when it started, we were actually broadcasting out of a really small closet. So considering we got from there to right now owning a fairly large room in the local rec center, I'd say we've come a long way.
Heroes only exist in the past, but the history of the future will reveal the heroes of today and how they change the world.
We'll leave you with some more music produced here in FCM.
Thanks to Flamo City Media's Adil, Taryn, and Mikey for that piece.
Nobody touching me, Rosa. I'm untouchable, King. I got powers too, X. I'm incredible, Mandela.
They try to put me down, but I keep my head up.
Through the struggle.
They try to put me down, but I keep my head up. Cause like a ball player, I just drive through. I'm on another level, you couldn't stop me
if you tried to.
Your negative is nothing to my positive. No, so determinated, there's no way that you'll be stopping it.
That was Mini C, Elastic, and Lomo with Black History Rap. You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News. We are listener-supported, not-for-profit news. To donate, visit www.ncra.ca. This month, Israeli Apartheid Week marked its sixth year of activities around the world. CFRC's Christopher Curry reports from Kingston, Ontario, on the thoughts behind and reactions to Israeli Apartheid Week in Canada.
From its origins at the University of Toronto in 2005, Israeli Apartheid Week has become a global phenomenon. This year, IAW events were held at cities across six continents. 13 cities in Canada participated, the highest number of any country. For the second year in a row, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at Queen's University held Israeli Apartheid Week in Kingston. Featured events included an introductory address by Adam Shapiro, a founder of the International Solidarity Movement, discussions of Canadian foreign policy in Israel-Palestine, and a panel discussion on the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. In Toronto, Israeli Apartheid Week took place amid intense media scrutiny and condemnation from the political elite. Here in Kingston, the response was more muted. Kamal Riley from SPHR at Queen's explains.
There was no confrontation this year on both of our parts, on our part at SPHR and the IAW organizers, but also the opposition just never showed up. The discussions we were able to have at the talks were actually pretty engaging. At the same time, I'm not entirely convinced on its effectiveness. Next year, we may choose to take a more aggressive tone again, like they do at York.
In the build-up to Israeli Apartheid Week, I spoke with Adam Shapiro about the Israeli apartheid analogy and its usage in North America.
To draw attention internationally to the reality of what is happening in Palestine and to Palestinians certainly reminds people of what apartheid was in the South African context. Use of this terminology, I think rightfully so, should awaken both a memory in people around the world of what apartheid was and the evils of it and why it is still going on today.
Within Israel itself, the term apartheid is used with increasing frequency. Former cabinet ministers have made use of the term in published articles. Here in North America, there's still more of a taboo around the word. I asked Adam Shapiro for his opinion as to why this would be.
I don't think it's just simply the use of the word apartheid. I think in general, and for many years now, we have seen more truth being told about what Israel is doing, how it is behaving as a state and as a government. We're seeing more of that truth being told in Israel, and yet there remains this taboo back here in North America especially, and I think that very much is related to the role of pro-Israel lobbies, both in the United States and Canada, which are extremely strong, although I don't think we should give them over credit. But there is this historical taboo about doing anything to criticize Israel for fear of being targeted or labeled an anti-Semite. But I think that effect is weakening.
The primary focus of Israeli Apartheid Week 2010 was the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. While this initiative does not enjoy universal support in pro-Palestinian circles, many regard it as the most effective means of bringing Israeli policies under international scrutiny. John Elmer here explains the logistics of the strategy.
Each can be participated in boycott on the individual level, divestment on the group level, church level, community level, and then sanction is a national project. So you have a three-pronged strategy where people can enter on the ground floor at the boycott and ultimately work their way up.
Shortly before Israeli Apartheid Week began, the Ontario legislature passed a motion condemning the event. By way of comparison, the legislature has not passed a motion condemning the ongoing siege of Gaza. For CFRC Radio, this is Christopher Curry.
Now to Toronto, where blind transit users are being refused service on the city's accessible transit service, Wheeltrans. Karen Llewellyn reports from CHRY Toronto.
On an average day, more than 1.5 million people choose public transit in Toronto. Among them is graduate student Kevin Shaw. But he's not doing it by choice. Kevin is blind.
So now that I'm on the subway, there was some difficulty in finding the stairs at Shepherd Station. Lots of things in the way.
It's not that simple for me to just get on the subway and then go somewhere. I can attempt that, but those trips end up being very frustrating.
In most cities offering public transportation, he would be using paratransit. That's the accessible travel alternative for people with disabilities. The TTC and Wheeltrans, its paratransit division, don't think the blind should use the service, however. In fact, they go out of their way to keep blind applicants from qualifying.
Wheeltrans had contacted a third party, a blindness agency in Toronto called Balance. When I got my Wheeltrans rejection letter, I had found out through some back channels that my case had been discussed between Wheeltrans and Balance, and that included my medical information. You know, that made me feel a little violated in terms of privacy. There's something wrong here. The blind person, him or herself, should be speaking for themselves, saying, this is a service that I need.
I don't feel that Wheeltrans is very compassionate to what our needs are.
That's Louise. Louise got turned down by Wheeltrans 3 times.
The TTC does not treat blindness as a disability because we're not getting Wheeltrans. You know what? You walk in there with a white cane and you're blind and you can't see. What more does it take?
TTC spokesperson Danny Nicholson says the TTC believes its accessibility initiatives like braille signs and stop announcements mean the blind don't need Wheeltrans. He points out the Commission's Advisory Committee on Accessible Transportation includes disabled members. Blindness community activist Linda Spinney wants Wheeltrans to recognize the diverse needs of blind people.
I applied 3 years ago as a blind person or visually impaired. I found it very frustrating to be oriented in the community independently. I was turned down. I think it's a waste of time, their system, but I had to appeal to get accepted. I just think there's a lot of people behind the scenes who do not understand what we go through. I don't think it's fair for them to consult an outside agency. Blindness is a disability. Wheelchairs should be available for blind and vision impaired adults.
Kevin, frankly, has had enough. He's written an open letter to TTC Chair Adam Granbrony demanding change.
You know, even as a blind person, I have a right to a livelihood. I have a right to make a living, you know, as a musician, and sometimes that's going to be in a part of the city that is inaccessible. Not every single blind person experiences blindness the same way. Independence to me means being able to freely move about without any type of restriction. Dignity seems to be one of the things that is missing from this definition of independent travel.
I would tell the chief to get a blindfold with a white cane in the winter especially and try getting on a TTC bus and see what it's like.
For Grandwire, this is Karen Llewellyn.
We go now to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where the city has recently apologized to the former residents of Africville, a community that was destroyed in the 1960s under the banner of urban renewal. CKDU's David Parker reports on the mixed reactions to the apology and the agreement signed with the Africville Genealogical Society to settle its 14-year-old legal action against the city of Halifax.
In a press conference on February 24th, Halifax Mayor Peter Kelly apologized to the former residents and descendants of Africville, Nova Scotia.
On behalf of the Halifax Region Municipality, I apologize to the former Africville residents and their descendants for what they have endured for almost 50 years. Ever since the loss of your community, we'd stood on the shores of Bedford Basin for some 150 years. You lost your homes, your church, all the places in which you gathered with your family and friends to share and mark the milestones of your lives. For all of that, we apologize.
The Halifax Regional Municipality and the Africville Genealogy Society reached a deal in what many are calling backroom negotiations. The deal would award $3 million in compensation that would go towards erecting a heritage site with a museum and a reconstruction of the historic church. The money would be matched by $250,000 from the Canadian government towards an African Nova Scotian Affairs Department. Some community members were overjoyed. Brenda Steed Ross is a former Africville resident who was evicted along with her parents and her infant daughter when she was 18.
We got to look to the future. We got to look for our youth. And the future is bright. And the apology and all that's to follow is what's going with us and to help us with our future.
Some community members were outraged. Eddie Carvery has been living at Seaview Park, the former site of Africville, in a protest caravan for 10 to 20 years. He is demanding a public inquiry, individual compensation for former residents, and the land to be returned to the community.
I'm still in Africville, right today. Anybody riding by, they can see my little caravan of freedom fighters fighting for what we all should be fighting for. I'll say our fight has just started. Anyone that agrees with me will come out to Africville and we'll fight for our individual compensation. We will fight for a public inquiry. Thank you for the apology. Accepted. Two more to go.
Denise Allen is a former resident who claims the settlement process has been illegal. Here she provides some historical context.
Africville was a vibrant community until the government permitted the invasion of hazardous industries such as three dumps, four sets of railway tracks, a coal factory, a tannery, a mill, nail factory, infectious disease hospital, Rockhead prison, fertilizer plant, etc. And the list goes on and on and on. What they did to Africville is the most blatant and extreme illustration of environmental racism I have ever encountered, the purpose of which was to chase the people of Africville out by hook or by crook, in order to control access to the valuable land lawfully bought and paid for by the Africville residents. The people of Africville were denied any consultations on any of the hazardous industries that no other community would accept in their backyards. The people of Africville were denied services, including public schooling, water, sewage, firefighting, paved roads, sidewalks, recreational facilities and policing, waste removal and electricity, all services that the rest of Halifax enjoyed. To say that Africville reminds us of a stark example of how racism permeates Canadian society is an understatement. The people of Africville have been victimized by anti-black racism. The compensation settlement does not come close to making up for what was stolen from the people of Africville. Today, the government is forcing its will on the Africville Genealogy Society in a patronizing way, having dictated the terms to them. Hardly what you would call good faith negotiations.
For Groundwire, this is David Parker at CKBU in Halifax.
Do you enjoy talking about Africville?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Because it hurts me.
Why is that, Mr. Sheehan? Why does it hurt you to talk about Africa?
Because it's one of the nicest little communities I ever lived in. And to tell you something, I've been around this world twice. I've never met a place like Africa. Never.
But Mr. Steed, everybody thought it was such a bad place. All the people who tore it down.
No, the people that tore it down. That's the people that tore it down, the city of Halifax, the authorities of the city of Halifax.
They said it was a bad place.
That's what they called it. But it was not to us, it was a heaven, a home, a real home.
You can't put a price on the lives that they grow. No nothing, why would you do this? Divide my people to fight out on the corners at night. Oh, Africville, look what they've done to me.
It's a part of our history they kept in the closet. Professors never taught the lessons, they neglected, forgot it. They kept it underneath the table, kept it under the surface. Nervous that we were re-emerging, they dispersed us and jerked us out in Africville. Halifax is ill, how can us blacks rebuild? When the facts reveal, the government left them comatose. And younger and the older folks in black Nova Scotian souls are frozen. Many homes are broken, drugs started creeping in. Crime started seeping in, the heaven got crushed. When the demons started sneaking in, a black community lost and trampled, left out in shambles, dismantled, and it's still hard to handle.
That was Africville by Black Union. Communities across Canada and around the world marked International Women's Day on March 8th. Sarah Feldblum of CHMR in St. John's reports on how the St. John's arts community is celebrating the global event.
St. John's, Newfoundland is the oldest English-founded settlement in North America. There's a traditionalism that's very alive in the culture of the city. Here, slang for a woman is Mrs., and anyone from your boss to a middle-aged man who regularly passes you on the street might call you darling. But there is also a history of strong women heartily taking on challenges here. This International Women's Week, St. John's, is flooded with events to honor womanhood. I spoke with Michelle Bush, director of Eastern Edge Gallery, an artist-run center in St. John's that hosts an annual International Women's Day exhibition.
I think it's important to always remember that no matter what people say, women still aren't equal on all levels in society. We need to celebrate the amazing, awesome work that we all do. You know, promote that and make people aware of the supportive structure of a lot of organizations that are based around women.
I asked Michelle why International Women's Week programming is supported and produced at the gallery annually.
The gallery was built up by quite a few really strong, fabulous women artists. And at the time, and even now, it was really important to create a space for women artists to exhibit and to promote their work. It's one of the elements that the gallery adheres to, that it's really important to have diversity. It's important to have women presented.
This year, she said Yes Theatre Company is hosting the 4th annual Women's Work Festival for Works in Progress by Women Playwrights for 3 nights at Eastern Edge Gallery. And the International Women's Day exhibition has brought in 2 artists from Montreal, Julie Lequin and Janice Yanyan Wu, who are mounting pieces called Top 30 and Knitting Machine. This is Sarah Feldblum of CHMR in St. John's, reporting for Groundwire.
That does it for this edition of Groundwire, a nonprofit national news program produced every 2 weeks by our communities for our communities. Groundwire is heard on dozens of campus and community radio stations across the country. This edition was produced at CKDU on Mi'kmaq territory in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Groundwire thanks the Canadian Union of Public Employees for their support. To get in touch with Groundwire, email groundwire@ncra.ca. All episodes of Groundwire are available for listening or podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. That was this week's installment of Groundwire Community Radio News, coordinated by the National Campus and Community Radio Association. It's now time for us to take a quick break, but stay tuned. After these short announcements, we'll have your weekend weather forecast, and hopefully, after today's gloriousness, we will be in for a mighty fine couple of days. We'll let you know that in 1 minute right here at News 101.
UBC's International Week is March 15th to the 19th. Celebrate international perspectives and activities right on campus. You're promised to find something that will tickle your interest.
Attend a talk by renowned speaker Paul Rusesabagina. Fly by the cultural fair, have a bite at the food fair, or check out at the grand performance. Make iWeek a part of your week.
UBC's International Week, March 15th through the 19th. For more information, go to iweek.ubc.ca.
It was a beautiful day. I felt so...
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC in Vancouver at 101.9 FM and streaming from your computer at citr.ca. The current time is 5:36, and it's time for your weekend weather forecast. For that, we turn to Denise Diatic. Denise, how's it going?
It's going pretty well, thank you. So here's your forecast for the weekend of March 19th to 21st. We're moving steadily forward from a mild winter into a sunny spring. The high pressure system should continue tonight and into Saturday, bringing mostly clear skies. Tonight, we'll have a low of 2 degrees. Saturday, mostly sunny with a few clouds, high of 12 and a low of 3 degrees. Showers will most likely develop Saturday night until Sunday as a colder front hits Vancouver. But still, temperatures will be mild. A Sunday will be a high of 10 degrees with a low of 5. And now, the answer to last week's trivia question. The largest hailstone ever found was 44.45 centimeters and fell in Coffeyville, Kansas in 1979 and weighed 0.76 kilograms. Youch! This week's trivia question is, what is the highest recorded world temperature and in what country? The answer will be revealed on next week's show. So that's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. Currently, it's 8 degrees and clear at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diatic.
Well, thank you so much for that, Denise. And before you go, I just have one question for you. So you're saying around 45 centimeters. Can you say off the top of your head, what's 45 centimeters? Is that like a soccer ball?
Yeah, it would be probably a soccer ball, but weighing about the same amount as a baseball or something,
oh
if you can imagine.
God.
So it'd be pretty dense. If that hit your umbrella, you'd be in for some trouble.
Well, thanks so much. We look forward to hearing your next fact on Friday.
Thanks.
In campus news, you may have seen 10 students clad in orange on the street this past week, sleeping outside the UBC bookstore, stinking up your class, and clinking cans in lectures as they engaged with 5 Days for the Homeless. In this campaign to raise awareness for funds for homeless youth in Vancouver, we have in studio to speak about their efforts. This is, I have Kaylee Estelle and Ben Capilacci. How are you guys doing today?
Not pretty bad. Good.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining me in studio. Maybe first you can just tell us, what is 5 Days for the Homeless, and what were you guys doing this week?
Well, 5 Days for the Homeless is a national campaign that's happening all over Canada right now, and it just concluded today. Basically, it started 3 years ago here at UBC, and 10 students sleep outside for 5 days to raise awareness for homeless people and their issues, and they also raise money as well.
And so, national campaign here at UBC, is there any type of group or group of people who organized it?
Well, in terms of 5 Days for the Homeless here, our chair was Raina Kai, who's been awesome. She's run it through the Commerce Community Program, but we've had students from all over UBC, not just Commerce directly, and she's pretty much run the entire thing with the help of Sarah Layden and the group of 10 of us.
Great. So starting Sunday night, you guys hit the streets, and I guess just as of you're now off the streets as of 39 minutes ago, so congratulations for that. Maybe, Ben, you could tell us a little bit about this year's success. I take it you also participated last year, so how did we do this year in comparison to last year?
Well, compared to last year, there was quite a big difference. Last year, we raised $15,000, which beat our expectations, which were actually $12,000. The big difference this year was that we only received $4,000 in external sponsorship. What that means is that we raised $11,000 through the donation of students across UBC campus. So starting at 8 in the morning and going to pretty late at night, we had students going into classrooms, making presentations, talking with people about what it means to be homeless, and basically being everywhere we could possibly be on campus to raise this kind of money. So in terms of our own expectations, we really broke it that way. It was really, really successful in our opinion.
And so this $15,000, is this going towards any type of organization? Where is this money going to be spent?
So the organization that we're supporting this year is called Directions, and it's a service that exists downtown at Hastings. And basically what it does is it provides support services for youth between the ages of 14 and 22. So it's a pretty widespread service in the downtown community. And what it's been able to do is really change the lives of a lot of youth that have come across Canada. And what's been great about that is that we actually had some of the youth come and visit us during the week. And those guys were absolutely amazing. They really showed us that being homeless doesn't make you a different kind of person. In fact, we got along really well with them. And they really showed us a lot more to what it means to be homeless. It was great.
So, Kaylee, maybe you could tell me about, after having spoken to these types of people, or these people who you're helping with this organization, how is your experience these last 5 days similar to what they might be going through, and what kind of things were you actually doing these last 5 days?
Well, obviously, we can never fully experience what these kids have gone through, but it really gave a tangible connection to what we were raising our money for. These kids have... they're amazing. They're just like you and me, except they haven't had the privileges we've had. They haven't had the love from our parents. They've had to sleep out on the cold ground just like we have. I mean, it gets cold out there. Like, few of our participants woke up with frost on them. So it's just, it really feels good to know that you can help make a difference. If you're bringing one person off the street, we're satisfied. You know, these kids were awesome. They all have completely different stories, but it all breaks down to the fact that they need help, and hopefully we can do a little bit to help them.
And so maybe you can tell me about the actual I guess kind of the activities that you engaged with. You know, you were sleeping outside of the UBC bookstore, if I'm not mistaken. What else were you guys doing?
Well, we basically, I don't know if you guys know, but we could only eat the food that was donated to us. We didn't shower, so we smelled absolutely terrible, and we had no disposable income, so we couldn't buy anything. We relied heavily on donations. If we wanted to brush our teeth, we waited until a toothbrush was brought to us. If we wanted to go to the bathroom, we could only go to facilities when they were open, just as a homeless person would do. So other than that, we also had to partake in our actual school activities. A few of us wrote midterms this week. We went to all of our classes along with class presentations. And, you know, we hung out at the pit trying to get money from everyone after St. Patrick's Day. And we were around. We were raising awareness. We were continuing in our extracurriculars. I played volleyball, and that didn't add to my hygiene at all. But I tried to keep along with my daily life while still adding to the authenticity of what we are actually doing.
So maybe, Ben, you could tell us about your experience doing this. You know, you're one of our recently elected AMS representatives and obviously one of our kind of elite of UBC. So how is this for you? Was this a kind of an awakening experience?
It was definitely a bit challenging. I mean, going to meetings and going to classes and meeting with university officials, it's hard on the best of days. But then when you haven't had a great night's sleep, your stomach's rumbling because you haven't had enough food to eat. When you're, you know, tired and sort of confused from all the things that have happened during the day, it definitely makes things a little bit difficult. But at the same time, it's been really, really rewarding because we've been able to understand a lot more of what it means to be homeless. And one of the things that I remember the most was that this one girl came by and she had 7 Subway sandwiches. And she said, "Today is my grandpa's birthday. He always wants me to donate something to homeless people for his birthday. So here's a few sandwiches for you." So it was really cool because we got to share this with the Directions guys because they were there at the same time. So we had a bit of a lunch circle and talked about our stories and whatnot. But it's definitely been a very challenging experience. I was one of those people that had frost on their sleeping bag one morning. But at the same time, it's been an experience that was definitely worth the sacrifice.
So maybe you could tell us, it's kind of reminiscent of that whole nickel and dime campaign that we saw with Mr. Barack Obama. You're saying that, you know, $15,000, where only $4,000 of it was coming from that official sponsor. Did you find that it was easy to connect with students? Were you, was it highly visible? Did everyone know what you were doing?
Yeah, we gained a lot of momentum as the week went on, but the generosity of students was overwhelming. We would bring our jars to classes, and after we sing our presentation, we just hand the jars around, and Each and every single person would put in 5, 10 cents. Some people would put $5 bills, $20 bills, and as the week went on, people kept giving larger and larger amounts. And that's what really impressed me, that people's generosity seemed to be endless. Where most people would sort of just walk on by, a lot of people here at UBC were really, really excited about the program, and they actually approach us on the street and offer donations, which is really great.
And so, Kaylee, maybe you can tell us if students are just hearing about this now, or if they weren't able to donate, nobody came to one of their classes. Are there other ways that they can get involved? Are there other ways that they can help out?
There's absolutely other ways. I mean, if you're not donating online, you can donate your time. I've had people come up to me and ask, well, I didn't hear about this, but I really want to get involved. There's tons of things to do in your community. I mean, we all hear about things that are completely other countries or continents, but right here in your own city, there's so many different things you can do to help. Volunteer at a soup kitchen, look into next year's 5 Days for the Homeless campaign, go down to Directions. There's a lot you can do, especially on campus. We have so many people who are willing to help make a difference. Just look at, like, there's so many volunteer opportunities. So I definitely recommend it for a lot of people. It's an amazing experience.
And Ben, maybe before we go, maybe you can just tell us some of the different ways that you've engaged with this through your academia. Is this something that, you know, is particular to students, or do you think that this is an issue that all Vancouverites are engaging with? You know, we just had the Vancouver Olympics here, and we saw, you know, that big tent city protest. Is this something, you know, students were engaging with it because they're youth or students? What do you think about that?
I think it's something that students were definitely able to identify with. The fact that it's students trying to live the life of homeless students, I think it was really important. But at the end of the day, it is a Vancouver-wide issue. For people that are sort of normal to be taking this kind of risk and really going out on a limb, I think it's really important to recognize. We had some people from Shaw and a couple other people interview us just to sort of get the word out there. But it's something that we really advocate for. 5days.ca shows that we have a whole bunch of people all over Canada that are doing the exact same thing. So it's clear not even just a Vancouver issue, it's a global issue. And with the Olympics around, it really has sort of come to the forefront. But we're all about sort of making a positive change and trying to show people that this isn't very easy, and it's something that people try really hard to get by on. And by sort of bridging the gap between students and homeless people, I think this week has been really a great opportunity to show how productive people can really be.
So while on the one hand you're engaging with students and you're able to kind of raise all that financial support for these people, were you able to engage in any type of activism towards members of parliament or MLAs or any of our city councillors? Is this a political issue that you guys were trying to address? Do you think that it's just up to students to raise the money, or what else do you think people could be doing?
In the long run, I think that the politics will come with awareness, and that was the biggest goal with our campaign. We wanted to make sure that people were cognizant of homeless issues here in Vancouver. We hope that the organizations that support us and the organizations that we're supporting will eventually take this to a higher level, but we wanted to make sure that within the UBC community, people had a great opportunity to understand what it means to be homeless and have something that they can really connect to. And that was sort of the overall ambition for us here.
Great. Well, before we go, Kaylee, do you have any last comments, or do you want to share one of your favorite stories from sleeping on the streets these past 5 days?
Favorite stories? It was just meeting the kids that we were helping out. They are amazing, and like I said, they're just like us. So give anything you can help, and like give time or money.
Great. Well, thank you both for coming down. We really do appreciate it, and we appreciate your efforts. This was Kaylee Estelle and Ben Capellacci, who are part of the 5 Days for Homelessness that was taking place here at UBC these last 5 days. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9, and we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we will have your Friday, March 19th headlines from FSRN.
Radio audience. My heart.
We're investing industrial noise and goth. Tune into the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights, right here at 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver, www.citr.ca.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
The UBC Film Society is proud to present A Hard Day's Night Beverage Garden this Friday, March 19th, featuring a live performance by local Beatles tribute band, The Fab Forever. Tickets are $8 for the public and $5 for Film Society and CITR station members. Doors open at 7 p.m., the film starts at 8, and the band immediately following. This is a 19-plus event, so be sure to bring two pieces of ID. Come see the classic film, have a drink, and then enjoy an authentic live Beatles experience with The Fab Forever and the UBC Film Society.
The 10th Anniversary Vancouver International Dance Festival is taking place March 12th to March 21st at the Vancouver Playhouse and Roundhouse venues. The 2010 lineup includes Vancouver companies Mascal Dance, Kokoro Dance, Lumenco Rosario, and Out Inner Space. Ontario's Toronto Dance Theatre, Taiwan's Lafa and Artists, Denmark's Kit Johnson, New Zealand's Black Grace and Bill Crutchmaster Shannon, Michael Sakamoto, and Evidence from the United States. The 10th Anniversary Vancouver International Dance Festival. March 12th to March 21st at the Vancouver Playhouse and Roundhouse venues. Tickets are available at 604-662-4966 or online at vidf.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live in Vancouver and streaming from CITR.ca. In international news, we now turn to free speech radio news for today's headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli warplanes have carried out a series of air raids on the Gaza Strip over the past 24 hours. This after rocket fire from Gaza yesterday killed a Thai farm worker in Israel. FSRN's Rami Almagari has the latest.
Local hospital sources in Gaza say recent Israeli attacks have left two civilians injured. Israeli air raids targeted three underground tunnels, a metal foundry, and two open fields. Many residents here in Gaza City were enjoying a Friday holiday as the air raids began in the other parts of the region. Mohammed Abu Sha'ira and a friend were walking the Jondi al-Majhul public garden.
Youth in the Gaza Strip are not afraid of a second or third war. We are going to defy Israel. What has been taken by force should be restored by force, not by negotiations, which are nonsense. What has been taken by force should be restored by force.
Meanwhile, a Gaza-based armed faction says it launched mortar shells at an Israeli army base in eastern Gaza Strip. In the past 24 hours, Palestinian armed factions have carried out at least five rocket attacks, according to Israeli media reports. Since the 2009 Israeli war in Gaza, the ruling Hamas party in here has been calling for a ceasefire, though the recent actions of Israel in the West Bank have prompted armed factions in Gaza to increase the use of homemade rockets. Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a conciliatory call to U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in an effort to smooth over recent diplomatic bumps. Israel announced new settlement plans during Vice President Biden's visit last week, despite U.S. calls for a settlement freeze. The details of the phone call have not been released, but prompted the U.S. to say it would attempt to restart the peace process. Today, Secretary of State Clinton is in Moscow, attending the quartet meeting on the situation in the Middle East. FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports from Russia.
The United States, European Union, Russia, and the United Nations concluded the two-day quartet meeting in Moscow by condemning Israel's plans to expand its settlements. The quartet issued a joint statement calling on Israel to abandon any expansion in East Jerusalem. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke to reporters after the meetings.
The quartet believes these negotiations should lead to a settlement negotiated between the parties within 24 months that ends the occupation, which began in 1967 and results in the emergence of an independent, democratic, and viable Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security with Israel and its other neighbors.
Analysts said the statement by the quartet displayed an unusually harsh line toward Israel regarding its affairs of state. Today's statement also calls on Israel to dismantle outposts erected since March 2001. Jenny Johnson, FSRN.
Press conference audio courtesy of RT News. Yemen's president announced today that the civil war between the government and the Houthi Shiite rebels in the northern part of the country is over, according to Al Arabiya TV. Fighting over the past 6 years has displaced tens of thousands of civilians. The parties were in the midst of an uneasy ceasefire. The rebels have agreed to remove their landmines and roadside bombs and have released pro-government fighters. The government promised to release Houthi prisoners as well. But many feel the peace will not last because the government still hasn't address the underlying causes of the conflict. Countries across the globe will not curb their trade in polar bears or bluefin tuna. This after two proposals to ban the practice were defeated as part of the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species of Wild Fauna. Delegates have been meeting four times a decade since 1975 to decide how to shape international trade in light of conservation needs. Countries voluntarily adhere to the convention. Polar bears are experiencing habitat loss due to climate change, and bluefin tuna have been fished to the point of population collapse. Canada led the fight to defeat the polar bear ban. Many of its indigenous groups depend on polar bear hunting and trade. During a short debate, Japan and Canada both fought the proposed bluefin tuna ban, saying the International Fishing Treaty Organization, ICAT, should be responsible for regulating the industry. Japan is the world's largest consumer of bluefin tuna. The World Wildlife Fund says ICAT has repeatedly failed to sustainably manage the fishery. The WWF also says the lack of debate on the issue was scandalous. Mercury emissions at half of the nation's most polluting coal power plants increased between 2007 and 2008, according to a report released this week by the Environmental Integrity Project. The report says overall, mercury emissions by the top 50 polluters did fall, but only by a quarter of a percent, despite repeated promises from the industry that it will improve. Power plant mercury emissions in at least 11 states, mostly in the South and Midwest, have increased in the past decade. Five of the top 10 polluting power plants are located in Texas, which is planning to build several new coal-fired plants. The Environmental Integrity Project says these emissions could be cut significantly with the installation of modern pollution controls. And finally, openly gay U.S. Army Lieutenant Dan Choi appeared before a D.C. judge today after being arrested while protesting the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Lieutenant Choi and another officer, Lieutenant Jim Petrangelo, both handcuffed themselves to the fence of the White House during Thursday's protest.
But at a time when there is discrimination and when there is a time that America is being betrayed by its own rules and its own laws, it is not a right to be silent.
Everybody please move back to the street, please.
It is my responsibility.
Audio from YouTube. Last night, supporters gathered in Fresno for a solidarity rally. Today, another rally is planned in New York City. Both lieutenants pled not guilty to the charges against them. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And we thank FSRN for making those headlines available. Those were the headlines for Friday, March 19th. And be sure to check back on Monday here at CITR News for the next update of headlines from FSRN. And ladies and gentlemen, that is our program for March 19th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to get involved or share your comments, give us a hot news tip, you can contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News as well for up-to-the-minute updates, or you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. For more news, please join us on Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepink, and I'm happy to say that on behalf of the entire news team, thanks so much for listening tonight. Stay tuned for A Hot Mess, which is coming up right here on 101.9 FM CITR, as well as streaming from your computers at citr.ca.